Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ann Rashid, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the writer Jamie Riston Colbert. Jamie Riston Colbert is the author of a new novel, Shark Girls, and a linked stories collection, Dream Lives of Butterflies, that won the gold medal first place in the 2008 Independent Publishers Awards in the short stories fiction category. She has also published a novel, Climbing the God Tree, winner of the Willa Cather Fiction Prize, and the fiction collection Sex, Salvation, and the Automobile, winner of the Zephyr Publishing Prize. Her stories have appeared in numerous journals and anthologies and have been broadcast on NPR's Selected Shorts. Originally from Hawaii, she is an associate professor of creative writing at SUNY Binghamton University. Welcome to the show, Jamie.
Thank you, Anne. It's great to be here.
Would you mind reading a selection from your new novel?
I would love to. And just to set it up briefly, this novel is about a shark attack that happens in the 1950s off the coast of Oahu. And the victim is a little girl, and once her leg is amputated, she lives, but she becomes seemingly something else. She never talks again. And when she's grown up, a lot of myths begin to evolve around her. People think she's a healer and a mystic. And the story is narrated by Susan Catherine, who's called Scat, her older sister, who basically is trying to figure out what happened to the family. Once the accident occurs, the family falls apart. Scat herself grows up, and she becomes a drunk and a disaster photographer. And at the time of the story, she's middle-aged, and she's looking back at various things to try and figure it all out. And the excerpt that I'm going to read is when she's a young woman, basically college age, and she's recalling coming back and actually going out into the water where the shark attack happened. And shall I just begin?
Sure, go ahead.
Flashback, the worm scientist. I had been thinking about how I could count my visits home to Hawaii since leaving for college on one hand plus a toe. The worm scientist was the toe. JC's 50th birthday and my 27th summer. I'm an alcoholic, but not admitting it. Believing I can control it, that it's perfectly normal to start every day with a Bloody Mary, it has tomato juice after all, and that every day can start at 1 or 2 in the afternoon. Whenever I finally wake up, crusted eyes, hammering head, skin a shade of ground-up taro, hungover from the night before that, a darkness that begins in the afternoon, beginning again the next afternoon. Time loses its definition when the hours are determined by which drink and how many. I don't think I even came close to loving the worm scientist, but it was not without a concentrated effort on my part. I believed I would never find anyone nicer or more appropriate, as JC might label it, husband material. I wasn't exactly a catch myself, staggering from one boozy bout to the next. And so I brought him to JC's birthday party, a gift of sorts, my hat off to normalcy. JC took me aside after he had gone to fetch us, my mother and me, yet another drink, and rasped into my ear, "You'll have short children if you marry that one." Short or not, he gave me back the gift of the sea, made me love it again, that which I had feared, for the time we spent together diving into its cool blue below the surface world. A summer night he takes me to see the fireworms, or a hula hula, as Hawaiians call them, which translated means hairy cord. Floating orange bristles, they are heart-achingly brilliant, abundant, their spawning triggered by the full moon, clouds of eggs and sperm like blown bubbles. He teaches me about other sea worms, some that are filter feeders, some that stalk their prey, some who even eat their kin, a riotous bunch of whiskered and segmented animals, slithering over coral heads, inching out from tubes, having evolved these sexual beasts into 18 ways to reproduce themselves, including breaking into pieces. I think about that, breaking into pieces, eliminating any need for another person. Like my photographs, I realize now, pieces of me. When the worm scientist is asleep, I slide away from him and curl into my own nudibranch form. To move in a sinuous manner suggestive of a worm, the American Heritage Dictionary defined this, my lonely separate thirst. On our last dive together, what will turn into our last day together, we drive out to Covella, where the shallow bay water is a clear, pale aqua, and the deeper ocean just beyond the reef dark as dusk. It's there we are headed, the long swim out, our masks, fins, tanks, regulators, weight belts, tools that will let us become a part of this world for as long as our oxygen holds forth. We both take a long pull off our water bottles before submerging. Mine is mostly vodka. Thank heavens for the clear ones. I learned this from my mother. Gin, vodka. You can funnel it into bottles where it's disguised as the other you poured out. We used to watch JC before heading uptown, dumping 7-Up into the sink, her gin into the 7-Up bottle. If the worm scientist suspects, he doesn't say it. Don't ask, don't tell. Bobbing on the surface of this inky water, he tells me what we'll be looking for, carnivorous worms, ones who use their jaws to nab other worms, fish, creatures much larger than themselves, and acorn worms. Acorn worms, he tells me, have toxic skin that discourages predators, and their head can regenerate if severed. Plus, they have gill slits, like an embryonic human or a shark. Then he dives down, our usual game plan, him first with me following closely behind. Only, this time I didn't. Because at first when I hear it, it sounds like a song. I am entranced, all grin, in love with the sea again, and it's singing to me. Imagine sirens, low and mournful, though not so mournful, sort of unearthly, like the ocean has brought forth whatever is in its deepest, strangest depths, a world unknown, uncharted, untouched, unfouled by humans, and put this to music. The kind of music waves make, wind over the waves, the slapping, pulling, slithery sounds of the water itself, undulating, alive. Then I see it. It is not the sea, after all. Not close, but not far either, sort of taking its time, humming, gliding, humming, swimming, side stroke, breaststroke, leisurely in control of its world, this ocean, its curving commands, meandering through it, the way we might part long grass in a field, stalks of corn, something rooted to the ground that we walk upon, thrusting it aside, certain of our destination, our place. So she approaches me. For I know she's a she, must be a she, must have always been she, her fin in the low sunlight, kaleidoscopic, like it too is made of this translucent water, this world that is hers and not mine. A singing, humming, beating, and I'm aware that it is my own heart too contributing to this song, this keening, erratically and painfully alive, pushing up toward my throat a rogue wave of fierce and ancient blood. I do not move, not even a panicky kick of my fins. What's the use? Her fins are cartilage, something that belongs, not the rubber of mine. Mine were made in imitation of hers, after all. I should have been afraid, is what I will imagine afterwards, terrified, in fact, but instead am mostly numb. It seems fitting somehow, my sister, me. I think about the worms we were supposed to collect today, the ones who can regenerate their heads. In another year, Willa and JC will begin the first of their disappearing acts, and the rumors will start, the regenerated leg. But of course, I can't know this yet. What I know is she's directly in front of me now, and I imagine us staring into each other's eyes, eye to eye, hers like mirrors, deep and sure, my own reflected in their glassy surface. Though naturally hers would be underwater, but I can picture it unfolding, slow motion, frozen time, like in one of my photographs, the moment before whatever it is we think we know ceases. My final thought at the end of this story will be one of regret, that I wouldn't have a child, that I wouldn't get to prove I could be a better mother than JC. Of course, the worm scientist saves the day. Flash of his long-handled knife for cutting worm colonies off coral heads, or the occasional shark. And he'll be so disgusted at my inability to be grateful, my lack of caring, that I was about to be chum, that he won't call me the next day or the day after that or any of the long, sultry days for the rest of the summer. And this, in turn, will become yet another excuse, a reason to drink, so much that even JC notices, suggesting that maybe it's time for me to leave. Of course, it didn't happen that way. The worm scientist surfaces with his specimens, he calls them in his collector's bag, a word that in most cases means that which was alive and will be no more. And no doubt he asked me, he'd rightfully be annoyed, why I didn't follow him down, floating willfully, he did use that word, on the ocean like I am my own raft, drifting away so that he had to swim out even further to fetch me, tired as he was. I'm fairly certain this was the moment when we both stopped pretending to care.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ann Rashid, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the writer Jamie Riston Colbert, reading from her new novel, Shark Girls. Love that excerpt, Jamie.
Thanks.
I have a question about Scat, the mm-hmm. main character, and how through the novel she's processing what's happened to her sister, but you really find out a lot about her as
yeah.
you go along, and the landscape of Hawaii, especially in that passage, I think is so integral to her identity. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about how nature and that landscape of Hawaii really is important.
Mm-hmm.
For her.
Well, I must say that having grown up in Hawaii myself, and having been transplanted to the mainland mm-hmm. For many years, it really, in my own memories, the islands, I sort of, my memory evolves around the physicality of mm-hmm. them a lot,
mm-hmm.
Such that when I was writing her, I would imagine her both with the heartbreak that she had as a child after her sister loses her leg and the family just falls apart,
mm-hmm.
And then also imagine her as she is now, which is essentially a middle-aged woman, trying to figure that all out while at the same time missing so much the landscape of Hawaii. So I saw her, you know, she is in many ways a broken person who is trying now. She was an alcoholic, or I guess you'd say she still is an alcoholic, but she doesn't drink anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just really trying to get her life together. So when I picture her as a child in the, you know, the sort of romantic beauty of the landscape, particularly the ocean
mm-hmm.
on the one hand, and then the other place where she ends up gravitating to, which is the big island in the volcano area, the volcano which has been erupting basically since 1980,
mm-hmm.
and the
mm-hmm.
landscape that is constantly changing and is a little bit more charged and violent. So I see her there as well. I see her and imagine her both as the adult she has become as well as the child she was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, definitely her having been in that landscape means everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Could you read another?
Sure. Actually, this time I'm going to transfer over to the other section of the book. The book goes, it alternates in parts, and the parts alternate between chapters that are from Scat's point of view in her voice. And then the other sections happen in Maine with a young woman named Gracie. And these are told in third person, who has had a disfiguring accident to her face, which actually this passage will tell about. And her connection to Shark Girl is that after Shark Girl has disappeared, apparently she was in the boarding house that Gracie gets a job in to clean, and Gracie moves into her room, and she becomes obsessed, basically, with this woman, particularly the fact that she's a healer, and, you know, obviously wonders whether she could be healed. And so eventually these narrating lines, or rather passages, paragraphs, chapters, etc., start to merge with Scat's story. But at this point, Gracie's section is just starting, so I'm going to read a little bit about from that. And this is chapter 5. Enter Gracie. The dream she dreams where she is not herself, surfing the wild aquamarine sea off the coast of Hawaii. She thinks it must be Hawaii. Where else would it be? Light playing on the waves, a clean white, sharp as her mother's white china, bone china, she calls it. Gracie used to imagine some poor soul sacrificing a femur for her mother's dinner plates, hip bone for her soup poles. Turquoise wave, froth of foam sucked up in the tube of this monster. She is the air it needs, the breath in its tunnel, split second of calm, of peace, the eye of the storm, and then the blue-green crash of the water around her, its flung spray, force of this rolling and flipping her board, and she's hanging on, and maybe she's even laughing. Because she knows it's a dream. She knows she'll wake up. Who drowns in their own dream? And besides, it isn't even her. At that moment, between sleep and wake, or is she awake? Sudden dark shadow, its sleek, silvery curve. In Gracie's dreams, she's often someone else, someone she doesn't know. A newly invented life born out of her synapses, out of her but not her. Always the face is perfect. Perhaps she is a man, craggy tan of a surfer, blue eyes, sun lines around those eyes. No other marks on this face. Perhaps in these dreams it really is her, her double, triple, not the face she must show the world, but the face under it all, and all she needs is to break free of the one she hefts about, the unreal one, into her dream and away. Unreal, the boys used to say, so ugly she's unreal, but only on one side. Want to check out her left side? Here, you see, is the cruel joke, the kicker, her killer left-side profile. When she drives, cars full of guys pull up, guy flies, drawn like insects to her long wavy hair, a hank of it blowing out the car window, a flag, welcome to the perfect one half of Gracie McNeely, the left side of her face. And then they see the rest. Things often happen to Gracie in triples. Take her face. Here is where it begins. Gracie's father drops her head first on a barbecue when she's 13 months old, like she's just another hamburger, seared to a flavorful crisp on one side. Didn't mean to. He is not a violent man. Self-violence, certainly. Violation of one's own flesh, one's blood, one's soul. And for the rest of his life, he will be reminded of this. Baby Gracie, slithering out of those helpless hands like some worm, some wet sea thing, like she's not even his, could not possibly be a part of him, his chromosomal material, because how could anyone do this to their own child? Her mother shrieking, throwing herself to the ground where little Gracie fell after first hitting those red-hot coals, the grill collapsing under the child's sudden downward projectile. The mother on top, as if her weight could press this baby back inside her, make her new again, undamaged, a glint in her eyes, unseen, unmarked, unknown, still that possibility of something perfect. For the rest of his life, Thomas McNeely will be unable to forgive himself, staring into the mirror at his own unmarked face, the genetic imprint of his daughter's features, can't escape those features, however corrupted, in these sure lines. Eventually, her father grows a beard, which her mother hates, and he keeps it there. The thing Gracie is allowed to touch when she reaches up to him, her child arms begging, and he turns away, just enough so that it is his beard her fingers come up against, his beard her fingers travel in and out again, finding nothing on the other side. Perhaps it really is Gracie her father hates. She's wondered about this sometimes, can't help but think it. Because every time he looks at her, he must be reminded of how he can never forgive himself. Of course, he's never said any of this to Gracie. Maybe he's never even articulated it to himself. She knows words like this, articulated, because she is her father's daughter, her father the professor, lover of books and the languages they speak to him in, of theories and how these offer a way to understand things. Though he never could discover one to live his life by after the incident, some theory of survival after you've done the worst. If Gracie hungered for the moon, her father would find a way to snare it, prepare it, serve it to her on the fancy bone china plate her mother would insist on. Grace's, she would say. How can Gracie live up to her name if we don't show her the way it's done? But he won't look at his daughter. Eat, he'd mumble ever so gently, liquidy blue eyes fixed on some space above her head. Her father's eyes are the sky, she used to think, staring up at them. There were the skin grafts, flesh dug from the baby fat thighs, the formless hips to form a new cheek. She had been airlifted to the Shriners Hospital in Boston, a specially equipped burn center for the surgeries, the physical therapy, and she howled through it all, Gracie's mother told her. You were never what you'd call a peaceful baby, Maisie McNeely advised Gracie, even before it happened. Always something so unsettled about you, Gracie. This on the eve of Gracie's move to Maine, but we'll get to that in a moment. Then the Bell's palsy 7 years later came on in the dead of night, it seemed. Maybe she's dreaming someone else's dream and she really does wake up in their face. How much rotten luck can one skin bear? Drooped on one side, the yellowish tinge, like some oversized sunflower neglected to fully open. The side already marred, rippled trenches raw as a new penny now hanging worthless as one, too. Because although a plastic surgeon might someday attempt to spruce up that scarred skin, there's not much to be done for the sag. Her doctor assured Gracie's parents that oftentimes this goes away. We can't be certain of what causes Bell's palsy, she said. Maybe a fever of some sort. The time Gracie had the flu and her mother sent her to school because she was hosting a fundraising luncheon for some Democratic legislature and the child might be in the way? More likely the trauma Gracie's poor face had already endured, damaged nerves, collapsing in on themselves in a sort of exhausted surrender. What makes it go away? It just does, the doctor told her parents, in most cases. Gracie is still waiting. Perhaps it will be the third thing that happens to her, the magical three. Wake up, and this time she really is no longer her. Stares at her face in the mirror, firm, smooth, nonchalant, and expectant, the face anyone else would take for granted, symmetrically even on both sides, skin the color of her neck, her hands, who cares what color as long as it's the same everywhere. And when she turns to look at both sides, as she always does, holding up the hand mirror to reflect off the larger mirror, gazing at the perfect left, the usual left, and then the right. These are the same. Gracie once read somewhere, in one of her father's sociology texts perhaps, or maybe a women's magazine, that the definition of a pretty face is one that is considered regular, unexceptional in every aspect, average-sized features, symmetrical alignment, forehead of medium spread, not too high or too low, eyes nicely ovaled, not protruding, just large enough to announce their color, cheekbones visibly present, medium full lips, a definite chin. Nothing about scarring, slanting, sloping, None of those S words describe a pretty face.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Anne Rashid, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the writer Jamie Riston Colbert, reading from her new novel, Shark Girls. I really think those two passages are interesting because both deal with breaking and characters who are broken in some way. And with Scat, it's that her sister is broken, and so she becomes broken after her sister is broken. And then you have Gracie, who's also broken in a way, and there's all those images of China, and the fine bone China throughout that, with the mother wanting to keep everything sort of intact and because of what has happened.
Yeah.
But the father and his grief is really evident, it seems, in that. I think it's in this book, I really am struck by how you write about the survivors of these accidents, and then also the ones who are living with what they've gone through. Could you talk about how you got interested in that idea in this?
That is an interesting question. The book was actually inspired by a real shark attack that happened when I was a child. Growing up in Kailua, Oahu, and it happened the next beach or the next town over in Lanakai, and a little boy lost his leg, and he also lost his life. Mm-hmm. There was a huge, huge reaction. Vigilantes were going out in boats shooting sharks, mm-hmm. and the territory of Hawaii sent boats out, and in the end, there were 630 sharks killed to avenge, you know, the life of this child. Mm. And it just always it left a huge impression on me. You know, you ask about the brokenness, and there was so much. There was the terrible tragedy to the little boy and the island family, you know, that this happened to. And then there was the tragedy of killing all these sharks. Some of them were rare, you know, never even to be seen in those waters, and obviously never again to be seen in those waters. And I guess it was, in fact, all the brokenness that stuck with me. And I knew that in some way I wanted to do the story, but I needed it to be my own story. I didn't feel comfortable taking that family story. And I'm not actually sure how Gracie's part came into it, to tell you the truth. It's interesting how that happens. You're writing along, and you think you're telling one story, and it changes on you. only in this case, I was telling the one story, but I was also telling a different story. And I thought, oh my, how will this ever come together? And of course, the way it came together was the way I explained before, where Gracie, with her injury, is desperate to find something. And she, in fact, finds where the shark girl's room was and is able to kind of follow her. And that's how the strands come together.
Wow. I that's another thing I've noticed, how so many characters end up intersecting and crossing paths in your fiction. And you do that so wonderfully. And, you know,
thank you.
Yeah, I really, really enjoy that about your work. Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
The writing of Jamie Riston Colbert. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.